Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Once again, it is my distinct pleasure and honor to reconnect with author Mark Cushman, who is a very, very busy and gifted writer with whom I've had the pleasure twice now of talking about a series of books that he has written called These Are the Voyages, which take us painstakingly through the Star Trek series, the original series, episode by episode, and helping us understand not only how each of those episodes came into being, the monumental work that was done both on camera and behind the scenes to bring each of those episodes to life, but also the overarching story of this phenomenally popular program, which in its day was embraced by all kinds of people in the public, but by no means understood by some of the leading figures of television who did not understand what they had and in a sense went out of their way to bring about its premature close. But of course, the public's love of this program is ultimately what won out, and Star Trek is still very much with us all of these years later. Mark Cushman's expertise in the world of television and writing goes beyond Star Trek. He has written a number of scripts for different films, as well as feature films like In the Eyes of the Killer and Desperately Seeking Paul McCartney. He co-authored a book about another important groundbreaking series, I Spy. And again, the most recent book, the third book of These Are the Voyages, is published by Jacobs Brown Press. And Mark Cushman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Great to be here.
So glad to have you here. Most people who follow Star Trek are pretty much unanimous in believing that the quality of the program went into rather serious decline as we got into the third season, and we'll kind of talk about some of the reasons behind that. But be that as it may, I remember at the end of our last conversation, you making the point that that decline actually, in a sense, enhanced the story for you, and that in some respects, this book that talks about the third season is your favorite of the three. Tell us a little more about why, in a sense, what's in a lot of ways kind of a sad, frustrating story of the third season is also a very compelling story for you as a storyteller.
Well, you know, as a writer, we love conflict. We love conflict in what we write, not in our lives. So we want it to be in other people's lives. And any story, you have to have a lot of conflict. And they sure had it during that third season. They had it during the entire run of Star Trek, going all the way back to the pilot, trying to invent everything they were doing, do a series that was unlike anything that had been done before. The closest you came to was Lost in Space, which kicked off 1 year before Star Trek. But really, Star Trek beat Lost in Space in filming its pilot. Its first pilot was filmed before Lost in Space filmed their pilot, so it just took a year longer to get it on the air with the second pilot they had to make, Where No Man Has Gone Before. But trying to live within the budget, trying to invent all the effects and the photographic effects and everything they were doing was a challenge. Nobody thought Desilu could pull it off or Gene Roddenberry could pull it off. And by the time you got to the third year, each season the budget got cut because it bankrupted Desilu, as you know, from book two, and a lot of people didn't realize that, is the board of directors told Lucille Ball, don't make this series. It'll ruin the studio. You'll lose the studio. And she stuck with Star Trek, and halfway through the second season, they had to sell the studio to Paramount. Paramount came in and said, we're not going to let this happen to us. You're going to make this show for less. And so everyone's getting raises. You have inflation. And at the same time, the per-episode budget has been dropped down. And the other thing that was going on was that Gene Roddenberry had been making enemies at NBC. The show was too topical. It was too controversial. It was even too sexy. I mean, that was America's first look at the miniskirt. And you had Kirk making out with all kinds of women, green-skinned women, Klingon women. You know, it was just too many stories that ruffled the feathers of the peacock. And so by the time we got into the third year, NBC was had their guns pointed at Star Trek. They had tried to cancel the show, and the fans went into an uproar. So they put it back on, but they stuck it in the death slot, Friday nights at 10 p.m. So you have a terrible time slot, a terrible budget. Gene Roddenberry left the show in a huff with the fight with NBC. Fred Freiburgers comes in, and he has no support, no money, and he's told that the show's not going to be renewed no matter what the ratings are, that NBC's hidden away at 10 p.m. on Friday nights. They're going to let it play out, and it's going to be gone. So that's the stage has been set, and you can imagine the drama in that type of a situation.
Right, and you tell that that drama very, very well. Your book is packed with fascinating information, and I'm excited to take it all apart. I want to actually take a moment though, and talk about something which is in the preface of the book. And you begin the preface of the first book on a very personal note as well, kind of talking about your very first encounter with this show, and when you lived in, was it rural Oregon or something, and you know your snowy TV with the rabbit ears. I mean, many times you could scarcely pull the program in, but when you could watch this show, you were falling in love with this show. You tell a couple of other really poignant and fun stories in the preface to this volume, talking about you and your parents and Star Trek. Can you just say a word about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll just touch on that first part for anyone who hasn't read the first book. I lived in a farm community up near Tillamook, Oregon, and lots of mountains around there. And we didn't get, on our farm, we didn't get NBC. We got CBS and ABC out of Portland. The NBC channel didn't come in except during the summer months through a snowstorm, as you said. And so all the other kids were watching the show, and the teachers would say, okay, homework, and there'd be a groan. And they'd say, okay, we know it's Thursday night, it's Star Trek night, no homework. And I thought, man, this is great. I don't know what Star Trek is, but I like it already. And the kids would tell me about it. And I noticed they were talking about the theme more than the story, and these were fourth graders. So I was very curious to see this show, and finally started catching it in the middle of the rerun season during that first year. Well, in third season, it goes to 10 p.m. Now, you know, I guess I was in the fifth grade, and back then, now fifth graders, I guess, stay up till 3 a.m. and gamble and smoke cigarettes and drink vodka. But back then, it was a different story. You know, 10 o'clock, you're in bed. It's, oh, come on, it's no school tomorrow. It doesn't matter. You're in bed at 10 o'clock. And, but it's also Friday night football at high schools. And I had three older sisters. And so they were very much into the high school football game. So the whole family would go out to support that. So I was told, well, you can come along with us and, you know, you stay up later. Or you can stay home if you want. But you got to be in bed by 10 o'clock. Well, they didn't get home till about 10:30. So, of course, I would be watching Star Trek, and when I would hear the station wagon pull into the driveway and the dog would start to bark, I would turn off the TV and race back to my room and jump into bed and flip the light off, and there I go. I didn't find out later, until later, my mother told me that my dad would come in and go over and fill the top of the TV set, and they could feel it was still warm. And they all had a laugh at my expense. And I thought, you know, I try not to get angry about that, but it was like, I love that show, and you knew I was watching it. Why didn't you let me stay up and watch the last half hour? It was tough seeing half the story, and I didn't get to catch the rest of those stories until it went into syndication. But that, I think that helped make me turn into a writer, because I would lie in bed and try to visualize how that episode ended. And then a year later in reruns, I could find out how close I came.
I was struck when you said something that implies, at least, that you and I think your friend Bob Olson, who was watching the show also, I mean, you weren't friends then. I don't think you knew each other then, but he had kind of a similar circumstance where he tried to figure out ways to rush home from the game and whatever football game he was at to watch that show or as much as he could.
It's very funny. We're the same age. We met after these books started coming out, and he wrote me a letter, and he was in Los Angeles, so we met and talked. And it turned out he was very involved in the Save Star Trek campaign during that, when the second season was canceled, and all the letters got them to pick it up for a third year. So I interviewed him, along with some other people who were out there actively writing letters and getting out and marching against the network and so forth, and found out that same situation for him, and I'm sure it was the same situation for a lot of kids our age at that time. And so he went to the football games, and he would find an excuse. He could walk home, and it was maybe about a half mile to his house. And so he would have an excuse why he had to go home, and he would run all the way to try to get home in time to see Star Trek. And as you may recall, I don't, you're probably not as old as us, but you'd get in there and you'd turn the TV set on. Back then, it took a while for that TV set to warm up.
I do remember that.
So he'd turn that thing on and be sitting there, and the sound would come in first as the picture's slowly starting to open up from the middle. You get the little white dot, and it starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you finally pull in a picture. And so he would try to get in there in time to catch the teaser and the opening title sequence, and it was always a big panic for him to try to make it home in time for that. So I realized at that point, that's when I decided to do this preface, is because I thought, you know what, if I found somebody else who was going through the same experience I was, there's probably thousands, maybe even a million people out there who went through the same thing we went through in trying to watch this show during that third year. And NBC did this on purpose. They were overwhelmed with all the letters that poured in and people marching against NBC in Burbank and against Rockefeller Plaza. And radio stations getting in on the act and getting people all riled up. And so for the third year, the idea was, well, let's put it somewhere where the fans are not going to be able to watch it. Let's alienate it from the fans. The teenagers are going to be out on dates. They're going to be out at football games, at proms. The young kids got to be in bed by 10. The older folk aren't going to want to watch it. They're going to be watching Jed for the Defense or the Friday night movie on CBS. And we'll just kill it. And then we'll be able to take it off the air, and there won't be a fuss. Well, there was a fuss. There still was a big, big uproar, and a lot of letters came in. But NBC was ready for it during the third year.
Unlike the first time around.
That's right. They had letters that they were ready to send out. They hired extra people to man the phones. And when all these letters came in, they sent out deceiving letters to you saying that the show was going to come back. And what they did is they took it off the air after the first run season, which was in April of 69. They showed the last episode of the third season. And they took it off the air for a few months, and then they stuck it in for about 12 weeks of reruns at the very end of the summer after the schedule had been set for the next year. And so we're writing in our letters saying, please don't take our favorite show off the air. And they're sending us a letter saying, don't worry, Star Trek's coming back. Well, yes, it is coming back in reruns for a few months, but they knew it was off the schedule. But they didn't want us to know that because they wanted us to stop writing the letters.
Mm. And, of course, you remind us, it's so important to say this, especially for younger readers, that this is back in a day where nothing like the Internet or email or Facebook or anything like that exists. So, in a sense, the dissemination of information and the exchange of opinion between strangers is all but impossible. And to whatever extent it does occur, it occurs over a much longer period of time. And so for NBC then to you make a couple of sort of funny curves in the road and sort of throw Star Trek fans off the scent, I mean, that might be all it would take to in a sense, send this down a very, very different path towards ultimate cancellation.
Yeah,
I mean, today you couldn't do that probably to the same extent.
Not at all. We not only did not have the Internet, of course. I mean, that's only been around, it's hard to believe, 15 years now. What did we do before it? But you know, you didn't have magazines like Entertainment Weekly, and you didn't have these Access Hollywood TV shows, and you didn't have, people weren't tuned in to showbiz news like they are now. So you didn't know what was being canceled and what was being picked up and all that. And so word of mouth had to go from person to person. But, you know, it wasn't that difficult. And I'll tell you why. Because Star Trek was so popular. Even though there's been this myth that it was a failure on NBC, and my books have disproved this because I licensed the Nielsen reports for all three seasons, for every episode. And you're seeing during that first year on Thursday nights, it was quite often winning its time slot. They moved it to Friday. It was still NBC's top-rated show out of all their Friday night shows. And when they moved it to 10 p.m., it quite often was still their top-rated show. It had, on average, about 20 million people tuning in every week. So a lot of people were watching this show, and especially people in my age group. I would go to school, and by the time the third season was on the air, I was in, I think, just starting junior high, seventh grade. And I didn't know anybody who wasn't watching this show. I mean, there was one kid who didn't watch it. He said, "Oh, I think Star Trek's silly." And, of course, he was then treated like a leper because everyone else, even the teachers, were watching this show. So we're looking around thinking, why is it being canceled? We don't know anyone who's not watching it. So there was communication between us, and somebody would come in and say, "Hey, it's been canceled," and suddenly we're all writing letters and so forth. And NBC couldn't figure out. They thought Gene Roddenberry was behind it all, and he was in ways because he was sending out letters through his mail order service letting us know who to write and things of that nature. But it really was, it had a large audience, and the audience communicated with each other. So we were organized in that regard.
I mean, to a remarkable extent, given that time. And we should also remember that this was back in the day when writing to a network meant taking out your stationery and writing something or typing something and then putting it in an envelope, finding a stamp, finding the address. And, I mean, it was not nearly the same thing as Googling NBC and then clicking on this and find that link and away you go. I mean, you really had to be committed to the idea of communicating something significant to a network like NBC. And for so many to be so deeply committed to doing that. It's really incredible.
You know, we were all very, very organized, and it's funny, even with all the communication we have now and all the access to information that we have now with the Internet and so forth, people were much more aligned back then because there were less channels. I mean, you just look even at popular music, you know, on Top 40 radio, you had everything from the Beatles to Frank Sinatra to Perry Como on the same station. So you were exposed to more things. It was more, you could have that Monday morning conversation by the water cooler at work. And if somebody said, "Hey, did you see this show last night?" Chances are, one out of three people or half the people you're talking to had seen it. Try that today. You go now and say, "Hey, I saw this show on HBO," and maybe one out of 10 people say, "Yeah, I saw that too." So you don't have the connection with people that you had back in the 60s where we all were a country watching the same things, experiencing the same things. So it was not that hard, really, to get organized. But it is interesting when I was writing these books and researching them and for you to be reading them, you can see how the seeds of this were planted. And how it grew from person to person to person and went through the whole thing. And they're out there protesting. You see pictures of them marching on the network and carrying their signs saying down with NBC and up with Mr. Spock and everything else. It was a very exciting movement to be involved in. So I guess we were either protesting about Vietnam or we were protesting about Star Trek.
Mm. We're speaking with Mark Cushman about his third volume in the series, These Are the Voyages. Volumes 1 and 2, by the way, were given a Saturn Award from the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, only the second time in the last 40 years that a book has been given such an award. I thought it was interesting that at some point you imply that even as a 13-year-old watching that third season, for as much as you loved Star Trek and remained devoted to it, you could tell that some things were wrong. That is, that this was not quite the same show as it had once been. And, of course, any show in which its viewers are so devoted, as were the viewers to Star Trek, the original series, are bound to notice things that were different. For you, what were the things in this third season that started to bother you, even as a young 13-year-old?
Well, you know, during the second season, Gene Kuhn left the show. He was the producer. He came in and took over for Gene Roddenberry, who moved up to executive producer at that point. And Gene Kuhn's background was mostly comedy. He had developed the Munsters, and he had developed McKell's Navy, and wrote a lot of he wrote westerns and war shows as well. But he really had a great sense of humor, and so he found a way to create organic humor in Star Trek. He saw the potential of it with William Shatner, who can be very funny, and with science fiction you can do anything. So they were doing some lighter episodes during the second year, like The Trouble with Tribbles and the Harry Mudd episodes. And Gene Roddenberry didn't care for this, because at that time, you know, the other show was Lost in Space, which was becoming like a science fiction sitcom, and My Favorite Martian as well. And so Roddenberry was very adamant that he wanted Star Trek to stay serious, and he wanted to make commentary on the political stories that were going on and the social stories and so forth. And he didn't like seeing any kidding going on the show. So he and Gene Kuhn had a falling out, and Gene left the series towards the end of the second season.
Gene Kuhn.
And when the third year came along and Roddenberry decided he wasn't going to line produce it because of the falling out he had with NBC, he brought in Fred Freiberger to do the show. Now, Fred, you know, Freddie, he had a sense of humor, too. Some people think he didn't, because the third series lacked humor. But that was Gene Roddenberry's mandate to him. And Gene Roddenberry actually gave out the first 16 script assignments, which nobody knew about. I did my research, so you're finding that out in the book. And so he told Fred, no humor in this thing. Really try to reel that in. So that's the first thing we all noticed, is that the show was suddenly, it was always a serious show, primarily. But suddenly the warmth between the characters seemed to be missing. And the other thing we noticed is that the pacing seemed slower, more like Next Generation in that respect than what we think of as classic Star Trek, where Kirk's getting in fights and there's lots of action and running and so forth. Well, what had happened also at that time, which I found out doing the research for this, is that was the year that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, came forward and said, we have to do something about violence on television. There's too much of it. And keep in mind, we had just come out of the 1950s and the 1960s with all the westerns. And there was a report that was written at that time that estimated that on television, on American TV, we had killed the population of the world three times over in 15 years of American television. And so they said, we have to do something about this. This is going to affect our kids. And so there was this crusade to take violence off of television.
I just want to interject. I remember so vividly, and I suppose you do too, how especially Saturday morning cartoons changed drastically, and it felt like it happened overnight, that shows that I just loved, like Space Ghost and the Herculoids and so on, vanished. And it was over this concern, perhaps a valid concern, I don't know, but a concern about violence on television.
It was overnight. That wasn't just in your mind. It was. It happened in the fall of 1968, right as the third season of Star Trek is premiering. And so even shows like Bugs Bunny and things like that, a lot of these shows were being taken off at Saturday morning because they were saying, well, this is too violent. Daffy Duck's getting his beak blown off in this episode, and you can't do that. So a lot of things are suddenly being taken off the air. And look at the iconic shows from the 1960s. It suddenly vanished almost overnight. The Avengers, the Wild Wild West, Batman. There was just a lot of action and violent action being done on television. So the FCC comes forward and says, we're not going to have this. Well, Star Trek had been an action-adventure show. And now suddenly it's kind of an intellectual science fiction show. And a lot of the warmth has been taken out. Now, it's still Star Trek. You know, you can watch those third season episodes, and it feels like Star Trek. It looks like Star Trek. But if you're really, really into the show, you can notice a difference. It's subtle, but it's there. So, and with the budget cut as well, you know, if you know anything about production, if any of your listeners know anything about TV production, you know, every time you move into a new room, a new set, or even a new angle of a new set, it's a different lighting setup. And so what happens with the budget being cut, you can't have as much movement. So poor Bob Justman, one of his memos that's in book 3 there, is he says, if we make it into a fourth season, which everybody knew wasn't going to happen at that point, but he said, if it happens, by the time we get there, the show's going to be one long scene in the briefing room where Kirk and Spock talk about what happened, because that's all we're going to be able to afford to do. So between the budget, between the humor being taken out, between the mandate for no violence, what had happened is it created a change in the show, and they tried not to make that too obvious. But you know, you can tell watching those episodes that something has changed.
Mm.
And it's not that anybody lost their talent. That's the main thing I wanted to do with book three, is that show that Freddie Freiberger was a very good producer and a very good writer, and he and Art Singer were rewriting these scripts to make sure the voices were correct and doing everything they could to keep the show feeling like Star Trek and to keep it good. But at the same time, they're dealing with issues that were just working against them in every possible way.
Absolutely. And, of course, there is also this matter, which we've already touched on, of the exodus from the series of so many key persons. I mean, Gene Roddenberry stepping away from day-to-day contact with the show, although he remained executive producer, but his actual interaction with the show, in a sense, really became less and less significant. And then you have other significant figures in Star Trek who step away altogether for various reasons. And so you have newcomers at the helm whose understanding of the show is a little more tenuous. And in some cases, they're learning on the job.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, Fred Freiberger, your heart will go out to him as you're reading book three, because this man, you know, he was the guy who put the Wild Wild West together. He didn't create the show, but he was brought in early in that show, like episode four, and really made that show work as far as combining science fiction and fantasy and Western and espionage and creating the character Dr. Miguelita Lovelace and all that. So, you know, very talented writer-producer. And but, you know, he was given a difficult job, and he found out nobody at NBC would return his calls. And so here's a producer trying to make a series for a network, and nobody at the network's talking to him. And he finds out that later that they're so angry at Gene Roddenberry that they don't want to have anything to do with the show or anybody that Roddenberry handpicked to come in and do the show. So they're all dealing with this situation. The burnout thing in television, you look at so many of these shows, from I Spy, which I did a book on, Lost in Space, Star Trek, Batman, The Avengers, all these were three-year series. And, you know, back then, they did about 30 episodes a season, where now it's maybe 20, if you're lucky. So they were doing more episodes. They had to film them in 6 days. And you had small crews, small staffs, so you have two or three people rewriting all the scripts. Well, after a year, you're exhausted. These are 16-hour days. And so by the time you go through three seasons, usually everyone's pretty much ready to go. You know, they just can't even get up to do another program. So it's not laziness or anything else. It's just exhaustion. We're human beings.
Hmm.
So, yeah, there was a lot of exhaustion in that show during that last year. Roddenberry was burned out and upset, so he left. But what people will find out and be surprised about in reading book three is his involvement with season three was actually quite a bit during the beginning, giving out those first 16 script assignments. You see a lot of memos from him on the development of the scripts and so forth. He tried to distance himself from it after that because he realized the third year wasn't as well received. So even he was saying, well, it's the new guy, it's Fred Freiberger. Well, not really. You see those memos in there, and his involvement is there, and it's his mandates that are saying no humor and so forth. But by the middle of the third season, he was gone as well.
Hmm. Before we dig into some specific episodes and some really remarkable stories, I want to just talk for a moment about Paramount and somebody that in at least some respects really comes off as a bad guy, and that's Douglas Kramer,
yeah.
Who is, he doesn't work for NBC, he works for Paramount.
Right.
But he is the person who seems to really control the purse strings here. And it's so interesting because as someone who's been watching this show for decades now, I mean, for 30, 40 years I've been watching this show, that's a name I've seen hundreds, literally hundreds of times. By the time you get towards the end of the series, that's the last name we see on the screen in the closing credits.
Right.
And that name, until I read your book, meant nothing to me. I had no idea who that guy was, but I guess if I gave him any thought at all, I would just think of, oh, and he's one more guy that helped bring us Star Trek. And we read your book and we realize this guy whose name is proudly emblazoned in the closing credits of Star Trek, as far as we can tell, he didn't like Star Trek at all. And he's one of the key figures in a sense, bringing about its slow, painful demise.
Yeah, he's head of production for Paramount, for the television division. He's the liaison between the studio and the networks. And he took over for Herb Solow. And you saw Herb Solow's name was the last name popping up during those first two seasons on Star Trek, along with a lot of other shows Desilu was doing, like Mission Impossible and so forth. But then Herb left to go over to MGM. Douglas Kramer comes in. And the new mandate is we're not going to let this show ruin the studio like it did Desilu. So he put down strict regulations that you stop shooting at 6:20 at night because they had to have the set wrapped by 6:30 or they were going to go into union overtime. And they could do it in 10 minutes. They were that quick and that efficient. So at 6:20, if they're in the middle of a scene, somebody from his office would come down and start turning off the lights. But you get it done, and if you didn't get all your shots, that's too bad. You're going to have to try to cut the scene together with what you got. Six days in and out during Gene Roddenberry's term during season one and Gene Kuhn during season two. Most of the episodes took 7 days to film. And that's something people didn't realize, too. They all thought, oh, it was a six-day show. No, usually it went seven. It was supposed to be six, but they all went over budget. Freddie Freiberger was the first producer who actually brought the series in on budget. That was his gift. He would write the scripts or rewrite the scripts so they could be shot in 6 days. They weren't as exciting, didn't have as many setups, but they could be done in 6 days realistically. So, yeah, Doug Kramer's office was very insistent that it be done. Now, that doesn't make him a villain. You know, he was doing his job. He was doing what he was hired to do. And he wasn't being hired to make Star Trek as good as it could be. He was being hired to make it affordable and not damage the studio. Now, in hindsight, you know, Paramount has survived off of Star Trek. That show became the franchise. And if they had known that then, they would have pumped more money into it and they would have wanted it to go to a fourth season.
Right. I mean, that's such an ironic development, isn't it? That Star Trek, rather than killing Paramount, being this black hole in which money's being poured that might sink the studio the way it sank Desilu, ultimately does just the opposite. And in a sense, you sort of, there's part of you that feels like Paramount doesn't deserve that. They don't deserve to be saved by Star Trek, although on the other hand, they're the ones who bankrolled it. I mean, this is a hard world for us to understand, those of us who live outside of it and peer inside, you know, through your book and by other means to understand what's going on.
Yeah, they didn't believe in it at all. When the show got canceled by NBC at the end of the third year, and it was supposed to be 26 episodes, they actually had two more episodes written, ready to go. And when they were in the middle of filming the 24th episode, Turnabout Intruder, word came down that the network had reneged and they weren't going to put up money for the last two episodes. And the studio didn't want to fund them on their own. So they pulled the plug. And it's a shame because these last two episodes, one of them was called The Joy Machine, written by Theodore Sturgeon, who wrote a couple of their best episodes, famous science fiction author. And William Shatner was going to direct it. So it was heartbreaking for everybody to lose those last two episodes. But what they could have done is they could have shopped it to the other networks. ABC probably would have picked it up. You saw a lot of shows jumping from one network to another. That was the year NBC canceled Get Smart and CBS picked it up. They canceled The Ghost of Mrs. Muir and ABC picked it up. But Paramount didn't even shop it to the other networks. What they did is before it even the last new episode aired, they put it up into syndication. And it was already bought in 40 overseas countries. It was picked up by 100 stations across the United States and it went up to 170 stations within a couple of years. So they made a fortune off of that.
We're speaking with Mark Cushman about his third volume, These Are the Voyages, examining Star Trek, the original series. And the heart and soul of the book, although there are these chapters that involve various themes, the heart and soul of the book is the process in which we're taken through each and every episode and the way in which each and every episode took shape. I learned all kinds of things in reading your book, and it was really quite fascinating. One thing that was quite striking was reading about two different instances in which essentially production stopped. In one case, because of William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, Kirk and Spock, refusing to do a particular scene. This is in the episode, Is There in Truth No Beauty? And a little later in the season, for the episode Whom Gods Destroy, Leonard Nimoy, again, who played Mr. Spock, refuses to go on because of his strenuous objections to a particular scene. Just tell our listeners a little bit about these two moments. It really helps underscore how much these actors cared about the program, even if, for instance, certain suits at Paramount did not.
Yeah, and another one, Plato's Stepchildren, which the network flew their censors out there, and when they were on the set, and that was the one with the interracial kiss, and they said, you know, this is not going to play well in the South, and we don't want you to do this, and so that was a big ado as well. But, you know, what is it, for Is There in Truth No Beauty, Gene Roddenberry had his mail order company running at that point, and fans would write in, and they could buy things, scripts and film trims and so forth. And he came up with this little medallion, the IDIC, I-D-I-C, and it was supposed to be about the Vulcan philosophy, about different personalities and different experiences combined make us stronger. And so he wrote in a scene for that episode and sent it over to Fred Freiberger and said, you know, put this in the episode. And it came down to the set, and they're rehearsing this this scene in the briefing room. And Nimoy and Shatner say, wait a minute, what is this? It just feels like a little infomercial plugged into the middle of this script, you know, so he can sell this thing through his mail order company. We're not going to do this. And, you know, Roddenberry felt it was a great idea. He said, no, this is what Star Trek's all about. This thing represents what Star Trek is about, and it's true. But the way it was handled, the way it was plugged into the episode at the last minute, the 11th hour, didn't really work. And so they refused to do the scene as written. And the guest stars are there, Diana Muldaur and David Frankham are there, and I interviewed them, and it was they were just amazed that they're about to shoot this thing, and suddenly the two stars of the show say, no, we're not doing it. And Fred Freiberger's called down to the set, and he can't talk them into doing it, and they had to call Roddenberry, and he had to drive over from MGM and come down and promise to rewrite it. They pulled the scene out, and they said, well, let's go on and do something else. And he went back and rewrote the scene for the next day, and they still didn't like it. And so Shatner and Nimoy ended up rewriting it themselves to make it more palatable for them to do. And that was the power that they had on that show. You can't do Star Trek without Kirk Spock. Now, they didn't flex their muscles too often in this respect, but it was coming down to where it was a butting of the heads between the creative staff and the actors. Everybody's trying to protect the show, and they're trying to make it as good as they can. Now, even Fred Freiberger didn't like the scene, but, you know, he's working for Gene. Gene sends it down and says, put this in. He looked at his story consultant, Art Singer, and they kind of shrugged their shoulders and thought, well, what can we do? He's the boss. We got to do it. So that was one. Now, Who Mourns for a – I'm sorry, Whom Gods Destroy. In that one, there was a scene where Kirk is what was the name of the actor? I can't remember his name right at the moment. But he's a shapeshifter, and he's able to make himself look like Kirk. And they're trying to get Spock to give a password so they can beam up to the ship. And Spock knows that, of course, that one of them is not real. There's one Kirk, and there's a fake Kirk. So in the scene, Fred Freiberger wanted them, the two Kirks, to fight. It made for a great visual gimmick. And Leonard Nimoy says, well, I know why you want to do this, but you're making my character look foolish that he can't figure out which Kirk is the real one. And I'm not going to do these lines as written. And so he went to his makeup room, wouldn't come out, and so they rewrote that script. So you see situations like this. I just had a lot of conflict during that third year as they're trying to preserve the integrity of the show. But they're all dealing with factions that say, look, we got to get an episode shot in the next 6 days, and this is the script we have. Let's go forward. And the stars say no.
Right. And, you know, there are also several examples in which dialogue will be trimmed out of an episode because of time. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, I mean, you cite, I can think of at least three or four examples in your book of information that's really crucial to an episode making sense that gets trimmed away just because, oh, we're a minute and a half too long, and snip, this comes out, and, yep. And information that is valuable, in fact, essential to the episode making sense, is suddenly gone. And, of course, if you're trimming a minute and a half from Get Smart or Green Acres or something like that, chances are it's not going to be the crucial matter that it is with a show like Star Trek. And then when you think about the way people watch a show like this, I mean, wanting to take it in on a really profound level, that just doesn't fly to be that careless.
Right. Well, you know, what part of the fun of doing these books, for me, writing them, researching them, for you, reading them, is you find out how much everybody cared. You see these memos going back and forth between the creative staff, and not just in writing the scripts, but also on the set and filming, every aspect of it, the editing, as you just mentioned. So you get to see each episode being shaped and all the decisions that are being made on how to make it as good as it can be, and fighting against the elements that are trying to make it as bad as it can be, save money, save time, just get it out. And they really worked hard on these things. And with Star Trek, you know, they were trying to do a very serious show that would make commentary on so many important issues. And they and Roddenberry and Justman just had a feeling this show was going to continue. You can tell from their memos that they felt they were doing something important. So they weren't going to say, well, it's good enough, just do it. You know, everybody wanted it to be as good as it could be. And so it's tough when you have to cut it down to make it fit 50 minutes, which is what it would be, not counting the commercials. And, well, here's a minute that can come out in order to make it fit. And it's a very important line. And a lot of the fights that went on between them and the censors. There's this one-third season episode. I don't know if you've gotten that far in the book, but Mark of Gideon, which was very controversial, as a lot of the episodes were, because this one dealt with overpopulation. And no entertainment show had done an episode about overpopulation before. And they even talk about condoms in this thing. You know, they're talking about ways to control it because the people on this planet were almost immortal. They had no disease. So they want to bring Kirk in and take his blood and create infection on this planet so people can start dying so they can have room to live. And very, very, very edgy episode. And the writers were very upset because NBC didn't want these things talked about. And so they kept cutting out a lot of the lines. And there was this one fantastic scene that got filmed and was then trimmed out where the guest star in the episode, this woman, she's on the ship with Kirk. And this is where he finds out why they have the population problem. She accidentally burns her finger off in the medical lab. And as he watches in astonishment, her finger grows back before his very eyes.
Mm.
Well, this is why you guys can't sterilize anybody or do anything like that, because your body is going to renew itself and you're going to just keep having kids. And they filmed that, and the network took it out.
Mm.
You know, there was an episode during the second season, same thing, Who Mourns for Adonis. In that episode, they had the Greek god Apollo, who was actually an alien, but he was perceived as a god when he visited Earth back in the days of old Greece. And he's lonely. He's living on a planet all by himself. He misses being worshipped, and he falls in love with this one crew member of the ship. And they had a scene in there called The Rape of the Wind, where his anger comes out, and she's thrown to the ground, and the wind's blowing over her. Well, the tag scene for the episode, McCoy comes on the bridge, and it's in the script. They filmed it. He comes on the bridge, and he says to Kirk and Spock, he says, I just did a medical checkup on her, and she's pregnant. And they kind of look at each other, and oh, my God. And one of them turns to her, and he says, is it? And he says, Apollo, yeah. And he says, so here's the question. Is the baby going to be a person or a god? And they filmed this, but it was not allowed to go into the air.
Mm. We get so frustrated that at the squeamishness of those in charge. And let on the other hand, they did allow some things to go forward, including, as you mentioned just a few minutes ago, that dramatic interracial kiss between Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura under the control of aliens in the episode Plato's Stepchildren. Actually,
that's a great story. Now, that one, you know, they in the script, it had Kirk is kissing Uhura. Well, the network fought that. They said, well, we can't have that happen. And everyone says, why? And then they realize, oh, because he's white and she's black, I see. And you know, NBC was doing I Spy at the time, the first show that had a white and a black actor working opposite each other in equal billing and sharing motel rooms as they traveled around the world. But, you know, to have these two people kiss is a whole different thing. And so they said, well, can he kiss Nurse Chapel? And we'll have Spock kiss Uhura. And
so it would be an alien kissing a black woman instead of a...
the pointed-eared guy to kiss the black woman, but not the other guy. You know? So they fought it and fought it, and finally the network said, okay, do it. Well, the networks have different levels of censorship. There's different offices. And so one office approved it. And then it gets up to the West Coast office, finally said, okay, do it. And then it's the day before they're going to shoot that scene, and somebody at the New York office takes a look at it and says, wait a minute, how did this get by? We can't do this. And they fly out there, and they're on the set, and they're getting ready to shoot the scene, and it's the last scene they're shooting that day, and it's almost 6:20. And they're saying, you know, you can't do this, you can't do this. And Roddenberry comes down to the set, and there's a big fight. And, you know, he was called, and he drove over from MGM again because this was very important to him. And to Fred Freiberger as well, who's the real champion of wanting to get that scene in. And they said, well, look, you know, we'll fight about it later. Let's shoot it two ways. We'll shoot it where he just kisses her on the cheek, and we'll shoot it where he kisses her on the lips. And then we'll fight with you and decide which one can go into the episode. So they shoot the real kiss first. Now it's about a quarter after six. They got time for one more take before the guys are going to start turning the lights off. Douglas Kramer people are going to be switching the lights off. And so they only get one chance to shoot the fake kiss. And they do it. It looks fine. The NBC people are happy. They leave. What they don't see is that when Uhura and Kirk kiss, William Shatner has the camera facing him. And he looks into the camera as he's kissing her on the cheek, and he crosses his eyes. And they do one take. So now the next day they're looking at the dailies, and it's like, oh, we can't use that. We have no choice. We only have one scene to use. We have to do the kiss. So they put it on the air, and everybody held their breath nervously. And over the next week or two, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of letters actually came in. People wrote letters to TV Guide about it. And I print some letters in the book there on this episode. And a couple of them say, Star Trek went too far the other night. But most of the letters were very, very supportive of this, saying, hooray for Star Trek. Finally, finally, somebody is saying, look, she's a beautiful woman, and what the heck? So, you know, that was one of those things where the cast, William Shatner, by crossing his eyes into the camera as he was doing the fake kiss on that very last shot that they could do that day, made it to where they had to use the real kiss in that episode.
Mark Cushman talking about the third in his series of books called These Are the Voyages, focusing on Star Trek, the original series. And on Monday's morning show, we're going to hear a little more from this interview with Mark Cushman. And we're also going to be hearing on Monday, because it's Martin Luther King Day, a portion of the conversation I recorded a couple of years ago with Rochelle Horowitz. She was one of the organizers of the March on Washington in 1963, that incredibly important event at which Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. That will be on Monday's morning show here on WGTD. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Supporting WGTD is the Metropolitan Opera, whose next high-definition simulcast is tomorrow at 12 noon. Franz Lehár's sparkling operetta, The Merry Widow, starring Renee Fleming and Broadway star Kelly O'Hara. For more information, go to metopera.org. Cloudy skies, seasonal conditions today with a high of 30 degrees. Overnight, just dipping to 25 for an overnight low. Cloudy tomorrow, some drizzle with a high of 39. This is